Listen in. It's time to talk about transitions into management positions or internationalization in exotic destinations. We could parlay over testing and progressive applications or talk relationships, but mainly please don't leave for other stations.
There are many fun and pretty useful things to know. You might even learn some on the Angular Plus show.
Hey, welcome to the Angular Plus show, where app developers of all disciplines gather to share their insights and experiences, and hopefully shed some light that will help you in your journey. I'm your host, Jennifer Wadella. Let's get started.
Hey, it's Brian Love with the Angular Plus show. Are you the type of person who always stays up to date on what's latest in the Angular community? Are you driven by intense focus to become a true expert in your craft? Would your career benefit from 3 days learning directly from the greatest minds in the industry? Then we'd love to see you at ngConf, the world's premier Angular experience. For tickets and to find out more, visit ngconf.org. That's ng-conf.org.
So I absolutely love it, but my husband would rather die than eat it.
I think that is a valid concern in a Midwestern household, to Jell-O salad or not to Jell-O salad.
Right, right. So, I mean, like, I really want to make my grandma's orange and carrot Jell-O salad because it's a really, like, precious memory from my childhood. But yeah, my husband would rather die than eat it. So I think it's a texture thing.
Yeah, I'm not quite sold. Like, and I'm already hit or miss on, like, whether I want, like, the Jell-O salad, like, on a good day of our family recipe. So if you go about, like, throwing, and you said shredded carrots?
Shredded carrots, yes.
Oh, I don't think I can get on board with this.
I mean, it's not as bad as its cousin, the perfection salad, which includes shredded carrots, shredded celery, cabbage, and pineapple. So, but yeah, it's sort of the milder version of the Midwestern Jell-O salad.
Oof.
Yeah.
Oof. This is why people hate Americans.
Midwesterners.
Midwesterners, yes. Yes, we traumatize people with our choices and overuse of mayonnaise, the northern Midwestern you get.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Well, we are back for another episode of the Angular Show. I am one of your hosts, Jennifer Wadella. I am the director of Angular Development at Bitovi. And with us, we have new guest host, Lara Newsom.
My name is Lara Newsom. I am a software engineer on the customer experience team at Cisco. Been on the podcast a few times, and I'm excited to be here today.
And today on the podcast, we are fortunate to be interviewing Zach Jackson, one of the co-creators of Module Federation. So we are currently doing a series talking about micro front ends. And since the release of Angular 12 and our ability to have Webpack 5 by default, we have access to all sorts of new shiny toys. So thanks for joining us, Zach. Will you give the audience a quick introduction to yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So my name's Zach Jackson. I'm a principal engineer over all of web for Lululemon. And I'm a big open source person, kind of built my career around it, maintained Webpack. That's pretty much what I enjoy doing.
Very cool. So when we get into things, we always like to kind of level set what we're going to be talking about. And I feel like everybody has their own different explanation for micro front ends. So will you hit us with your crash course of micro front ends?
Yeah. So with the addition of Federation, it's kind of created two patterns for creating a micro front end. The more traditional one that we've seen for the past like 5 or more years is you create a whole bunch of independently built applications, and you pretty much mount them onto different parts of the document. So you'd have a header, it's a standalone app, you tell it, render the header on the div called header, and it would render, and you know, you'd pretty much have them all completely isolated and mounting by default. Then with Federation coming around, we have this new kind of pattern, which allows us to maintain a single app tree. So it's one single page application, but the components inside of it work more or less like a micro front end. But you still have the design capability from a software standpoint to treat it as a single page app. So problems that usually get a little tricky to deal with in traditional micro front end is if I can't, like, I can't necessarily pass a function from one microfront into another, or I couldn't pass context easily. I'd have to use a message bus or some serialized format to communicate around the application. And yeah, so with Federation, you don't really have to do something like that. And you can have the kind of the best of both worlds. It works like a single page app, looks, feels, operates like a monolith, but you have all the benefits of a microfront end.
Very cool. So will you tell us a little bit about your journey? Because I feel like microfront ends conceptually are something still very new to a lot of people, even though we have been doing them for the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, maybe with iframes or something like that. But what was your kind of journey into it as an engineer? When did you start encountering problems that you were like, hey, we need a different way to solve this?
Yeah, so I have like a long history with web performance in general and pretty much getting code from places. So like where everything really started was back when we had server-side rendering, but you couldn't code split an application. And you know, that was kind of a big problem for our performance side. So, you know, I started to investigate how do we get code split server rendering to work. Pull requested Webpack, created the capability to do code split SSR. And that kind of got me on the whole Webpack journey. Code splitting did a whole bunch of things, made sites smaller, easier to load dependencies when you need it. And that solved like a majority of the issues that we had initially had. And then it got up to a stage where we started doing everything as independently shippable elements or something like that. And it worked pretty well. But the problem that you'd end up seeing is like once you start scaling up the concept, either we had like a rendering layer where you'd have to install everything in the company into the rendering layer, or you know, you'd have it on NPM in some form. And the problems you start getting is if I need to update it to use it in like say 3 locations, I have to publish the version, wait for the bot to pick up the change, open a pull request to the renderer, merge that, then open another pull request to some other app and merge that. You know, doing something small like changing the color of a button turns into, you know, arguably like at least a 30 minute change. Versus if you just did it in a monolith, you would just change the button hex value and merge it to your main branch. So it added a lot of overhead that is still effective for isolating things, separating concerns, autonomy, but it came with this massive overhead of, I just call it like the package bump cycle or the double deploy, where it's not just deploying anymore, but now you have to do at least 2 forms of a deployment, whether it's a package release and installing it, or you have to daisy chain it, because now what happens if something uses this, it uses that, it uses the other thing. Now you've got to go, cool, my carousel's used inside of like a molecular component. So I have to go to the molecular one, bump it, and then I have to go to the actual end user and bump it. And if you look at the development costs for something like that, I mean, if you say it's $100 an hour per engineer and doing a triple bump takes an hour, and you're developing mainstream features inside of these micro applications, you're ending up losing, you know, at least 2 hours a day per team member. And you got 300 team members or something, that adds up to a lot of operational cost.
I feel you there. We've had that problem on one of my clients where they have just a tragically slow internal NPM registry. And so you're talking a 5-minute CSS upgrade you want to make is going to cost 6 engineering hours by time it can actually be deployed. And I don't think we're accounting for that in our sprint pointing right now. So everything turns into a hot mess.
Yeah, that's the other thing I've also run into. And it's often just because I think how like product things usually work is it's really around, well, how long does it take to deliver the piece of code you type? Not how long does it take to get it through your infrastructure and actually push it into production. And this has bigger impacts on like the ability to compete against the market. If you're in a highly competitive space, often the ability to get something to market quickly and iterate on it quickly is a competitive advantage. So if your infrastructure is just slow, I mean, it's the same thing if you don't have like CI or
you don't have build automation or test automation,
it's going to slow down the whole development lifecycle. And that can end up causing quite a large business impact. But we never think about that as a firsthand you know, it's more of a frustration we deal with. And mostly it's because, well, that's the nature of the beast. There isn't an option to not do it. So we can't even factor that in because it's just part of how everything has to work.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to kind of dig into your Webpack experience and talking about code splitting there. And I want you to kind of like share a little bit about Webpack, because in the Angular world, with the Angular CLI, we have wrapped a bunch of Webpack functionality to where a vast majority of Angular engineers have never, ever had to do something in Webpack unless maybe they've had to configure a custom plugin, or they got really ambitious and they wanted something like ESBuild before it was ready, or maybe they're doing some sort of translation. So can you give kind of a high level overview of, okay, if somebody's new to Webpack, what are the things they need to know about to begin looking into figuring out how code splitting works, for example?
Yeah, so I mean, so this probably isn't the best advice ever, but it is a very, very good way to understand what you can do with Webpack is to just go and read the source. Like, that's how I kind of learned it was, I mean, the things that I would go in and look at specifically was, how does the compilation.js file work? How does compiler.js work? Like, really those top level main pieces that you hook into. From there, you can see, okay, well, here's how it actually works. Here's all these hidden options that aren't documented anywhere. So it's I would say that's a good like second step or third step to, you know, kind of brave it and dive in there. Initially, I would say like the biggest thing that is often a problem in human nature is just read the documentation. That will help immensely. Even though there's a lot of documentation to read, it's very useful to see, okay, well, how, like, what can I do without having to dive into the source or without having to write any custom plugin? How can I just leverage Webpack against itself to do something maybe it wasn't totally built to do? But the level of configurability you have at the end user level is strong enough that, like, I call it loopholes, but there's probably a better term for it. But you can find loopholes in the API where you can exploit it to do something a lot more sophisticated without actually having to go and
tap into its real APIs and write like a complex plugin. But yeah, like that's what I would say would be a good place to start, is to just get like a general idea for, you know, how do you configure a plugin? How do you configure a loader? What's the difference between a plugin and a loader? When do they run? Because that's also a really important one. Like,
I actually don't know that off the top of my head. What's the difference between a loader and a plugin?
A loader runs
during build.
And as Webpack's iterating over all your imports, it is pretty much taking in that source from it,
modifying it, and returning the outputted result. So like how Babel works is pretty much the source comes in, we push it through Babel, and we return another string back out. A plugin runs after the build is already done. So you can still go into a plugin, like tap into it, and say manipulate the file source without writing a loader. And, you know, sometimes you have to do that if you need like really complex things where you say you need to know everything about the build.
So in order to do that, I need to first run the compile to understand
the dependency graph or whatever. And then I could go in there, tap into the Webpack cache,
find the file and modify the in-memory result of it after the fact. But in general, like you don't want to go and mess around with the memory pointers on it. So yeah, that's the big difference. A loader runs in little context. All it really knows about is the current file you're processing, and that happens as it's compiling each file. The plugin happens after the first pass over all the source is done, and then you could start applying additional after-the-fact things like additional analysis or
data aggregation if you need to, or create like in more advanced use cases.
Like in many CSS, for example, we have a pattern called like a three-way communication. So it's a plugin loader combo.
What the loader does is pretty much writes instructions that the plugin reads at runtime. Because a loader, I can't really add code.
I can mutate code, but there's not like a good way to say add a new
global function to Webpack itself. With a plugin, I can add runtime requirements or something like that. So what we can do with a loader is say, all right, I'm going to add like a query string or some arguments onto this resource. And then when the plugin's running in the browser, it can read those parameters that you set at build time. And you can kind of tell a plugin what to do or how to handle a certain side effect.
And so it's like a part build, part runtime communication pattern. But it is really, really useful for trying to do like more complicated things.
I want to just go back to talk about, not necessarily to talk about, but to just encourage what you said about getting into the source code and reading it and really reading the documentation. Throughout, I think that it's really easy to be intimidated by that because it feels, to use in my words, it feels fancy, right? Like it feels like code I'm not capable of writing somehow, but like somehow you get into it and you're like, oh wait, this is it's just code. It's at the end of the day, it's just code. And it really is a great way to get in and actually understand what's happening and to see what's happening and to find the edges where you can actually hook into something and do something it's maybe not intended to do. So, because really all those things are just like a pull request waiting on the library, right? Like it's just not there because somebody hasn't had the time to do it yet. It's, you know.
Yeah, the biggest, I would say like half the problem with Webpack in general is the API surface area is so vast. I kind of view it as it's close to impossible to really document. So at some point you just need to go look at the source and see,
I don't know, trying to document like how the tappable system works. It's like an endless path of circular recursive methods. So it's really hard to say, cool, if you tap this, then it's going to do that. Cause it's like, well, it'll do that, then call itself again and do another set of things on it. So trying to just write that out in a sentence is extremely difficult.
Yeah, well, definitely.
And I feel like with Webpack, I don't know how it became so much more enigmatic, because if you remember like our gulp and grunt days, somehow it was so much more visual and we like, it was clear to see, okay, this is how I'm doing this. This is how this is actually getting injected into my index.html file. Because like, that's all we care about at the end of the day, right? Is our index.html file and putting whatever crap in there that we want to deliver. And I feel like in, yes, this vast API layer, we lose sight of what we're trying to do. And once you lose that like general abstraction concept, you as a programmer kind of are like, I don't understand anything, and it can be hard to dig out of.
I mean, I really did like the Gulp days. That was my favorite thing. I wrote things that should never have been written in Gulp.
Like a while back I created this it would take a sketch file and it would automatically convert it into a HTML CSS front end. Yeah, I export it as an SVG, and then Gulp would loop over it and do a bunch of iterations on the elements and auto-generate, you know, the full site.
Responsively designed and everything, with very little effort. So Gulp was really great with that whole piping concept. I think where Webpack, like, really shone a
new light on how we build things is
none of these tools
previously had this idea of omniscient context. In Babel, you would say, okay, regex this file and then pipe it to some other plugin and then do the same with CSS or whatever, but you could never ask Gulp, hey, which JavaScript files are importing CSS? Like, you couldn't retrace a dependency or something like that. It was all very kind of broken down
into individual concerns, which
is great in some ways, but it also has flexibility issues where, you know, with the complex apps we have today, it's really, really helpful when you can just query the entire code base and find out any information that you need to through the compiler.
Awesome. Okay, so let's, I feel like we've gone down a little bit of a build rabbit hole here. So I want to bring things back to the conversation around module federation. So tell us a little bit about what this creation looked like. Obviously, you had already been using Webpack for bundle splitting and you were not getting the results you had. So walk us through like the birth of module federation.
Yeah, so, you know, I started running into the problem of scale with the traditional NPM style. And yeah, so once I started hitting that issue, I was like, okay, code splitting's helpful for some things, but, and I think I started this, the idea first came to me in 2017, and it was a really primitive one of, well, why can't I code split from a different build? And turned out to not be possible to do, so I kind of left it alone for a year or so. Then sometime in 2018, I opened up a Git issue on Webpack around, I think I called it, I can't remember the original name for it, but pretty much the idea was like interleaved applications where, you know, since Webpack maps all this stuff anyway, and under the hood, it's just more or less a little map that points it to a resource, and I connect it through some way where I can call a function like require and it return a result. So
why can't we kind of spread that out further?
So I originally opened it in 2018. Then I continued to work on the idea originally in Webpack 4, because that's all we had at the time. And I came up with like a working concept, but it was really bad. And the API just wasn't there to do what we needed to do. But
the first iteration I had of it was
I created like a little extra function inside of a chunk. So whenever you would pull down like a code split chunk or something like that, the idea was if I can figure out
what chunk the thing is, like the element you want is in, I can just put that on the page and there's like a registration function
that I can hook into. So just by putting the JavaScript on the page, it's going to push some additional information over into Webpack and say, hey, I need this, 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 and this. Here are the assets for that. Here's the name and the version of whatever it is.
Then I could go in and check, okay, do we already have this? If we do, just recycle what we have. Otherwise,
I know what was registered and I can go and download it, kind of like sideloading it into the application scope. That worked pretty well, but
the problem that I found with it initially was
you'd run into a whole bunch of weird issues, like what happens when you add CSS, or what happens when you
do some kind of side effect where, okay, well now I also need a piece of loader code
to be teleported over into the other app. So what if I'm using file loader or the CSS loader in one, and I'm using many CSS in the other? Now one of them can't inject styles into the page because it just doesn't have that function there. So trying to go and find, okay, well, here's the CSS file, here's the JavaScript side effect for it, and here's the piece of loader code I need to bolt onto another app. I could get it to work, but I'd have to like code a solution per plugin that I wanted to use. Anyway, that got the proof of concept out there working, where I only download what I don't have. I can pull code from any build at any point, and it'll just work. From there, I went and spoke to the Webpack Foundation, said, hey, look, here's a working concept. This is previously said it's not possible to do. Here you go. This works. It needs to be improved, but, you know, here you go. Like, here it is. Do you want it? And yeah, pretty much they were like, yeah, this is great. We spent an extra like 3 months
rewriting the Webpack core
to incorporate Federation. A lot of it was just born out of frustration that we couldn't do this already. From a technical standpoint, there's nothing fancy happening. We push a script into the page and we
register it through somewhere. So
technically it's possible.
So why can't we just utilize it and
take advantage of it? And you know what it ended up leading to now is it's so easy to maintain things,
especially global concerns. If the MegaNav updates,
all you do is deploy the MegaNav and magically it's everywhere. So you don't have these kind of eventual consistency problems. There's no real overhead that we run into anymore. It's pretty stable in terms of like you can share dependencies, but you can also share them via semantic versioning. So if you use Lodash 3 and Lodash 4, it won't just do like what System.js does, which says, cool, here's a key called Lodash, you have to use that. But it can match the semantic version, you can make it strict version, you can put the little,
it supports all the NPM,
like
little symbols that you can put in front of the version number, and it can read that and interpret that at runtime. So it's a lot better at sharing things intelligently.
That really opened up a big opportunity. And I think the main issue that I had originally, beyond just I can't dynamic import from other bundles, which was irritating. But the other problem I had is if you want to use micro frontends, you pretty much have to create an externals file. So if you use Angular or React or anything shared, you have to create a third Webpack build that just creates these bundle dependencies. If that Webpack build fails or goes missing, your entire application will fail and there's no way to recover from it. There's no backup capability. Other things like, well, what happens if I want to upgrade part of the app to the next major version of React? You trying to do that through externals is close to impossible to support two same namespaces in one location. With the Federation capability, we added,
if this doesn't exist, download your own copy. So whether you run it as an independent app or you run it inside of another app, it's completely standalone. If you don't have it, it'll get it. If you do have it, it won't get it again.
Very cool. So like there's so many like music to my ears things as a consultant of like, oh, like this is how you deal with that. Or, you know, when we're trying to migrate large legacy apps, you begin to see that power of dependency management at that really micro level that makes it super appealing. So I want to kind of make this a little easier for listeners, especially if they don't have the Webpack prowess and experience that you have. Like the extent of their knowledge might be like, oh, CSS loader. Okay, check. That's the extent of my knowledge regarding loaders. If they're, you know, setting out and they've got a monolithic code base and they at least want to be start prototyping something with module federation, what are kind of like key high level concepts you think they should be aware of?
So, I mean, yeah. So the end, like federation as it stands is luckily pretty simple. Like the main goal of it was
we had micro front end libraries already
that could do something. They weren't necessarily as efficient or as flexible, but we had this whole concept of, you know, you register a module into some object somewhere and that's how everything works. But big problem I have with that is the standards all deviate everywhere. Nothing just works with anything. And you have to, there's a learning curve.
With federation, one of the nice things about it is you add the plugin, so 5 lines of code, realistically.
And then you just continue using require or import, and you don't change anything else about how you use the application or how you write code. And everything will just kind of magically work. So it makes it really easy to
get it up and running in terms of like a learning curve standpoint. Some of the big concepts that
I try to encourage is, like, one, if you're trying to look at federation or trying to look at the micro front-end approach in general, check out my module federation examples repo. It's kind of like the official, like,
location for anything federation. And I think we have like
40 plus different build flavors. You know, we have some that
we've patched compatibility for, like ES build. We have Angular, React, Vue.
Angular, React, Vue, and Svelte
all under one app. You know, all the kind of flavors that you could try to imagine we've incorporated. And yeah, I mean, so utilizing it is pretty simple. It's you add a plugin, you give it a name, and then you go import name/whatever thing I've exposed out.
Put it in a dynamic import and it pretty much works.
The other kind of things that I would say are important to consider if you're looking at building out
something using federation is really around
what's the API going to look like in the future. So we're very used to thinking about, okay, it's always a static hashed asset on NPM. It'll never change unless I bump it manually.
But at runtime,
you can also make it work versioned. So similar to NPM, I could deploy these remote containers
to some other path on the CDN. So I could say, cool, get version 1 of the remote, and you would have NPM-like lock file capabilities. But, you know, that requires some infrastructure change. So usually what I try to think about when you build it out is, how do you make whatever you're doing as self-sustaining as possible? That's usually what I try and look at. Just because you have the ability to make it work like a monolith doesn't mean treat it like a monolith, because teams are going to be changing these features underneath you. And if you're writing a feature
that somebody else is going to consume,
you want to think about, what's that API going to look like? What happens if I change the properties that get sent into it? So main thing I always encourage is don't export the file directly, but create like a federated file that imports the original feature you want and just re-exports it. But if you have to go and make a breaking change to the component,
you now can make the breaking change to the actual file that you're importing.
But what you can export out is like a compatibility wrapper. So you could say, all right, if they send me these instructions, transform it into the new shape that it needs to be in, and the end user still only pass it like 1 or 2 bits of information. And all the work is kind of self-contained in there to maintain compatibility or to have some kind of contract on what's agreed upon. That would be the biggest thing that I would encourage thinking about if you're trying to do something distributed in that runtime is
the, you know, change management portions.
Another one that everybody sees, the dependency sharing capability. So this is like a common misconception. Just because you can share dependencies doesn't mean you should share the entire package JSON.
The reason is we can't code split We can't tree shake it as well,
because we don't know exactly how it's going to be used. So I can tree shake it to some degree, but it's used in unknown ways. So if I'm saying, hey, here's Lodash, I have to some degree bundle extra code in there so somebody else could depend on a function that I might not have. So, you know, that's something you definitely want to consider. What I usually share is just the really important things. So singletons,
global stores, the core library itself, maybe like a pattern library or something large that is used everywhere. But I always look at the vendor sharing as a nice to have,
that you kind of
mostly take advantage of the ability to import features at runtime.
And vendor sharing is just a way to trim down the build a little bit more, but it's not the primary function, I would say.
So random question, and this is a little outside of just module federation and more into like microfrontend implementation, but have you come up with any rules? Like if you have new developers on a project, and they're new to this concept and they get told, hey, you need to go make or modify or build feature X. Like, do you have like flow diagrams of, hey, should I build this as a shared dependency? Like, where should this live? Or do you have rules that you've created around how developers begin approaching kind of this decision-making process that's a key part of implementing microfrontend architecture?
Yeah, so I've taken like a wider view on this in general. So what I try to build out, and granted, I've been working in software architecture for a while, so I've had plenty of time to make all the mistakes and sit through enough rewrites to kind of figure out what I don't want to do again. So what I kind of designed toward is this concept of component level ownership. So like what I currently build is I have a monorepo with a front end app in it.
Every page is essentially a sub app. So when you develop the verticals inside of there, you're developing it in a workspace, and you just have something like Next.js that just imports all the feature code from
this sub app. The idea with it is, well, once the monorepo gets too large and I need to cut the repo in half,
the component level ownership model is designed so that all I should have to do is go to the file system, select the folders, drag them to another repo, hit start, and delete the folders out of the other one, push it to production, and it's up and running again. So with that kind of
design pattern in mind, it makes it a lot easier to think about micro front ends, because we kind of treat every component to be as self-sustaining as possible. The kind of concept I put around it is, if I have a component or have something I'm going to expose to another team, be it Federation, NPM, or whatever.
The general idea is I should be able to mount it on a page that's not inside of this app,
give it, you know, two or three pieces of information,
and it should just run as the component should run as a standalone application. And, you know, you just have some decoration around it to maybe mock the information you usually send it. But if you follow that kind of design pattern, it's really easy to say, all right, do I want it at runtime? Do I want it on NPM? Do I just want to move it to a different sub app? You can scale horizontally, vertically, distribute, deploy it in any way that you want, and the model still holds up.
That regardless of where we move the code around, it doesn't really matter. So, you know, developing in the future or developing for the future, it's harder to know, hey, is this going to need to be federated at some point? Kind of hard to know that if, say, you start working on, say, a purchase attributes thing.
For e-commerce. And what happens when purchase attributes grows to tax calculation, to cart ads, to promotional things, to inventory checks? You know, what now it starts getting larger. Is it a team that owns that purchase attributes? And this kind of gets into, I think it's Conrad's Law.
I'm not familiar.
I might have the name wrong. Conway's Law.
I think it's one of those two. But the idea is the code base mimics the org structure.
And so
if we go with that kind of process, then the buy box or the purchase attributes probably doesn't hold the cart data primarily, or the cart components. The checkout team probably manages that and probably has to pull request a different repo to add this cart data or these cart updates onto it. So that doesn't really follow the org structure. But you know, this, so you kind of get to this point where what happens if multiple teams are contributing on a single
part of your site or a single concern? How does this ownership model
live into the potential for that to happen? So when I create the cart modal, it's just built to run on NPM, to work in, you know, work in all the various scenarios. And then in 6 months' time, if I need to use it somewhere else,
you know, I just choose which way of distribution I want to take advantage of.
And I think this also kind of sets us up for the async future that the libraries are getting into. So I mostly work in React, so React 18.
You know, we're going to have async components where data fetching can happen at the component level, not at the page level. And these also start to live more into the self-sustaining component level ownership model, where now I don't need anything from the page, like the purchase attributes. Realistically, all the page needs to do is say, here's the SKU for the product. And then everything it needs to do, server or client side, is completely self-isolated.
And my API is now extremely simple, which makes putting it on NPM, deploying it at runtime,
really easy, because I'm not having to chain, oh, well, the API changed, so I need to also make sure the data matches or whatever else. If all you do is give it an SKU and it just does its thing all the time,
it's kind of hard to break it.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the whole, just the concept of functional programming, right? Like the same input will always give you the same output. And like really, when you start to really think that way, your apps become so much stronger because you're not mutating stuff inside of them. You're not getting unexpected results. And I think once you start to move towards that, you really start to see the benefits of it. But it's I think it's hard for people to kind of get there conceptually at first, but it's definitely a good direction to head. So.
Yeah, it's like the thing that I've seen is usually in the price you have to pay up front mostly is, okay, how do we develop a platform around this? How do we create some kind of system for, you know, okay, if I want to use component level ownership, what does it actually mean? What's the governance around it? What's the standard?
What happens if you don't have an org chart? Because hello, been there.
Yeah. And, you know, what starts to happen, like, how do I know how to depend on this thing if they're changing the exports all the time? So usually, like, in the ownership model, I'll always say I use the three export rule.
Dumb component, data utility,
and then a smart component, which could combine the dumb component and the data utility. So it's completely self-sustaining. That way, consuming teams can just say, I want the data fetched with a new component, or I want my own data with the dumb component, or I just want it to automatically work and me just pass it one piece of information and it'll do its thing. And so, you know, a lot of this, even outside of micro front ends, I think it's just a good pattern for scale, because now, you know, the problem you start getting into is, here's a component. Now, what feeds it information?
Then you have to track through, you know, a 3,000-4,000 line utility file
and try and figure out, okay, what four lines of GraphQL query actually powers
getting inventory, for example. It'd be much nicer to go to the inventory component and right in there, there's four lines of GraphQL. That's just the query that powers it.
And you do something like how a pattern around import the component, import the data utility.
Use something like combine queries, so you only make a single GraphQL call, say at your page level, but all the individual concerns are easy to find, easy to debug, and easy to ship or split up without having to dig through the feature code necessarily of
the higher level application.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of this reminds me, so I don't have a lot of experience doing Angular module federation, but I did work with GraphQL federation. We went from the sort of monolithic GraphQL API that had all of the stuff going on inside of it to actually doing module federation inside the APIs. And it was like, oh, this is so much nicer. And it is, it's sort of the same kind of layers where you've got your API is still doing the stuff that it did before, but you've kind of got this wrapper around it. That's like, when I send you this, just this is what I want. And
yeah, go and point it to this other service that points to another service, so on and so forth. And yeah, like a funny little piece of info.
Module Federation, I stole the name or got the name from it from Apollo Federation, because I need a way to like communicate, okay, who's going to, like, how are people going to more or less understand what this is? And the easiest way was, okay, well, Apollo does something similar. So instead of
federation on the database layer or on the query layer, it's federation of the actual runtime. But the same principles more or less apply, where they're deployed independently and they more or less work in isolation, but they can come together under a single process and execute. That would just say this is the main difference between the two, is one is multi-server and one is kind of single process.
You know, just depending on how things work. A cool thing I actually did is I took Module Federation and combined it with Apollo Federation at one point, so that I didn't have to have the network overhead of every time I jump to the next service, I have to do the same call.
But I think Apollo has something like create server, that you can pass, and you can just give it like an array of resolvers. And so since Federation works on anything that can use the JavaScript runtime, we like there's some companies that
that the cars
are powered by module Federation, and it actually speaks to the microprocessors of the vehicle through the Federation interface. And so, you know, it works with any language. Like we can do, I have some that are JavaScript, C and Python and Java, all under a federated app. And I can call it through WebAssembly or pull in WebAssembly code at runtime from somewhere else.
So on and so forth. So since it works in Node, it's
super helpful for doing something like that as well, where, okay, I don't actually need a graph server standing up. I just need the resolvers and the schemas and, you know, all of those pieces. I just need that to be teleported to wherever it's needed at the point of execution. So being able to say, cool, Apollo, create a server, here's a bunch of federated functions and schema that I'm passing you, and you just add that on, it still uses Apollo Federation to like direct the query to the right piece of logic. But instead of using my network, I can now just pass it to another Webpack module. And it's a cool pattern.
Yeah, it's great. It's such a delightfully nerdy term too. Like, cause I immediately start thinking about Star Trek and the Federation, and it's like, oh, right. That makes sense. Yeah. Cause there's all these little starships out there like doing their own thing, but they know how to report back to the central hub. Right. So, and they all speak different languages or whatever, but yeah. So I, that's what I think of. I just turn into a giant nerd when I think of Federation. So.
Cool. So you touched briefly on this idea of contracts and trying to help, you know, navigate some of the problems that you might run into. What are some other just best practices or, you know, gotchas to avoid when people are starting down this architecture path?
I would say, yeah, the biggest scenario is, what's the abstraction layer look like? How are you going to provide some way to change the component as the underlying feature changes? So having that like export proxy on there or something like that. So they only send me this contract, and I always transform it to whatever the component needs underneath it. That's a really big one that I would say, having a pattern for that, like here's how it usually looks. So you don't have like devs importing or exporting just randomly named things, but like if you have a data utility, it's always export data utility. So I can blindly go and import the component, and I can check, does it have data utility? If so, that's the data utility, not you know, federated component versus export default or other weird patterns like that, where you can't predictably know how can I reliably always get something from another application. The other big one I would say is discoverability. So what's actually exposed and how does that work? And so the pattern that I'm using now, since I use Next.js, it has the whole concept of like pages. So
what we went and added was a federated folder. And it's pretty much the same thing, where I have the export proxy on there. So
only Webpack will only federate and expose anything in that folder. So in order for me to put a feature, in order for me to get a feature out there, I have to have a separate file for it. I have to import, export it out of wherever the actual feature comes from, like another monorepo or somewhere in source components, whatever. But now I can go to any app, I just go to the folder and I can see here's everything that they expose out.
The other big thing that this helps with is the testing aspect.
So if this is all at runtime, how do I know that it still works? You could do end-to-end tests, which is like,
yeah, nobody likes that.
But I was like, you sound super sold on this approach.
You could do, yeah. So the three ways that I've kind of discovered that are helpful is starting with like the most painful end-to-end tests, which is going to guarantee it always works. The other option is federated unit tests. So the idea with that is doing the same thing that we do for server-side federation, where I like have my Jest files bundled through a separate Webpack build for testing, and now all the federated imports automatically work. So I can just go and, you know, run a test, and it'll pull down the spec files or the federated components from somebody else's app, execute those unit tests on your box, and make sure that what I'm still passing works. It's a little, you know, there's some setup to kind of do to get that. You know, you have to have the unit test available somewhere that you can pull it down. So you need some VPN or S3 bucket or
some way for that communication to happen.
So the other pattern that I use, which is the most, like the easiest one, is if you have something like, say, a federated folder, or you have like a known place where these exports happen, you can create unit tests from the provider side,
where I go, all right, here's the JSON contract I'm always going to send to it.
I can create a mock for it. And then when my unit tests run, they pretty much go create a snapshot, pass the mock into it, and it should come out the same. If it fails, you need to go and fix the
export proxy or fix your underlying feature to make sure that that contract always passes, because that's what everyone else is expecting to
send it. So it's a nice way to make sure, well, whenever I deploy, it's going to still work based on the mock that I'm sending in. There's also this idea of liability tests,
which is kind of built on the whole federated unit test idea, which is whenever I deploy something, I go locate all my consumers of this module, I pull down their unit tests,
and I test their components under my application when deploying. And whenever they deploy, they pull down my test, and pretty much they both test each other
via unit tests. So if you deploy A or B, they both pull down parts of A or B and run those unit tests during their build. And that kind of guarantees that regardless of the direction, it would always work.
That just sort of broke my brain, but it sounds really good, because that is
the meme of the brain just like getting lighter and lighter and lighter explosion.
Yeah. I'm like, uh-huh. And like my grandma just nodding at me. Uh-huh. Sure.
I guess I wrote a little Medium article about this to kind of help conceptualize it. But the way I think of it is, say team A owns form and team B owns input.
Well, whenever form gets deployed, I want to pull down input and guarantee that input still works with form. And whenever input gets deployed, I want to pull down form, wrap input in form, and guarantee that input and form still work together. And so that's the kind of idea behind a liability test, where
you either wrap the app in
the other component, or it encapsulates it inside of its current one.
And yeah, it's a more laborious kind of way to do it, but it does.
It would give you the best guarantee that it's going to work regardless of what changes on either end, because you're pretty much running the tests from both sides on both sides.
Yeah, it sounds like it's worth investing in doing that, because that's definitely something that, even not with module federation, you know, you get an API team that changes the capitalization on a property and your entire app is borked, and then you have to go figure out what happened. And, you know, it's like, it's so easy to make those mistakes. And so those are really, like, since those are easy mistakes to make, so that's definitely where you want your, I would call them your belt and suspenders tests, right? Where you're like, I'm checking and then I'm checking again. So to make sure.
Another like really useful thing, like just for doing QA regressions and stuff like that, which is
where federation is also really handy, is since it's all dynamic and I'm not depending on any build time,
I can do stuff like go to production, add a query string or a cookie, or, you know, I can add some piece of information on a production, and I can repoint production resources to some PR build that I have up somewhere. And so you can pretty much debug in production, or like in other cases, like the one other thing I did was I have like the React Dev Profiler, which only runs in dev mode. But if I'm in production and I see a problem, I can do a reverse override and pretty much tell
the host, you have to use my, like, this remote's copy of React, and I can sideload the development copy of React into the production build without ever redeploying production.
That's wow. Legit.
Yeah,
I didn't even think about that. A micro front end module federation debugging segment of the podcast. I love it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And yeah, I think the one other cool thing I've done with reverse overrides and just versioning in general with federated systems
is I have like a GUI that I wrote that's backed off of like a GraphQL endpoint. And what happens is I have a Webpack plugin that takes the Webpack graph,
uploads it to the GraphQL database. And then what I'm able to go in there and do is I can pretty much query Webpack for anything that I want. So
every build deploys during its deploy, it pushes up to this, I call it the Medusa service, but I pretty much push it over to Medusa. And what I'll end up seeing is like a whole map that says, cool, header is used inside of here, in here, in here. It comes from over here. Here's the files in the other GitHub repo where it's being consumed. Like, here's the line of code you can find it on. Here's the versions of the dependencies that are installed in all the apps. Here's what they're sharing. Here's like the different versions of the federated module that exists. So
you can go into the UI and without redeploying anything, I could go in and like lock production to a different NPM package. So if I wanted to say update everybody to React 18, instead of going and pull requesting every single
code base and doing that update,
I could go into Medusa and just
choose from the dropdown. And as long as one of those connected federated systems is using React 18, I can just tell everybody else you have to depend on that
specific dependency that's deployed. So I can just go with the dropdown, change any dependencies at runtime, and also be able to go in and change the version of the federated module that's used. So if there's a problem in production, I don't need to redeploy anything or do anything like that. It takes 2 seconds to update production with
any part of the dependency graph.
That adds a lot of flexibility if you're looking at A-B tests, or you need to QA things, and you need a matrix, or if you just want to do end-to-end tests, you can hit this graph endpoint and say, cool, run this set of tests, then change the matrix, so switch the versions of it, rerun the same test set, and make sure that it works, you know, here, 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 and here. And based on those test results, you could send back to the API and gray it out, so the homepage can't use version 2 of header because it doesn't work, so it'll never bump to that one until the test matrix passed. But if version, you know, 2.01 works, you could bump over to that one. But you could kind of create those tests where even in the interface, you can't move to a breaking change.
This is a magical world I want to live in. So. This is not the magical world I currently live in. So,
right, well, if we want to help on a magical journey, what are some good resources or places people should go to start learning more about not only module federation, but just, you know, how to sustainably implement micro front end architecture?
So I can never pronounce his last name, but Luca, I think it's Mestarella. Anyway, Luca.
I know who you're talking about, so yeah, I can Google it and put it in the show
notes. Amazing beard. Yep. Bald head. There we are. So Luca is a really good person like to follow on Twitter. He's also come out with a new book that's called, I think, Building Micro Frontends. Federation is featured inside of there. And we really kind of went through what you need. Like, here's the pitfalls that you could make. Here's the design practices, just things you should think about from deployments to everything else. So that's a really good general resource for information.
His Twitter as well is also great for that. For me, I mean, I have Medium, but I don't really centralize any of my information. So I'll
write posts that talk on performance or
software architecture or something else. Generally, my Twitter is the most like where like the real-time consciousness comes in. And you know, if I come up with an idea, I'll tweet about it first, then go do it tomorrow at work.
But, nice.
Yeah, usually anything that I'm working on, I'll tweet about.
And what's your Twitter handle for our listeners to follow you?
Scripted Alchemy.
Cool. And we'll link that in the show notes as well.
Awesome. And then, yeah, then, you know, the Federation, the Module Federation repos or the Module Federation org on GitHub is also a good place. You know, we have the examples repo. We have a couple libraries, like, you know, we created backend architecture, like hexagonal backends that use Federation. And that's the one that does all the polyglots, so C, Java, JavaScript. You know, it's all pretty much set up. So, you know, we've developed some good tools around like good patterns for using
these things. But yeah, for general micro front end information, Joel, Luca, Michael Greers, I think. Yeah, Michael Greers, Cam Jackson.
They're all
great people to follow, and they all are, you know, heavily involved in the micro front end space in some way or another.
Very cool. Thanks for all that. So before we wrap up, anything else you want to kind of add for our listeners related to the topic?
I guess, yeah, here's like a couple pieces of information. Like we have this written in the Webpack docs, but everybody kind of misses it. And it's like one sentence, so I'm not surprised. But
what we have documented for Federation is really, I would say, maybe 20% of what you can actually do with it. So a lot of what's possible isn't really written down anywhere. So a couple interesting things that nobody really
knows about is, like, usually if you use the Federation layer, you have to give it like a URL.
Or, you know, you go like nav is nav at HTTP, or you can say nav is window nav or whatever. But you can also
use a syntax called promise new promise, which I can pretty much say, okay, well, Webpack is going to load this federated
container. It's going to wait for this promise to resolve before actually continuing on and loading the module that you want out of it. So if you use a promise new promise, it's great because you can like intercept it and say, well, when Webpack's trying to import it, I can get something like, who's the current app? Okay, the current app is the home app. Now go hit an API and say, I'm home.
Which version of the design system should I use?
And you could inject the script yourself and resolve the promise back to Webpack. And it would now use, say, a different namespace or something else that you want to inject, or you can put a logic gate in front of it. If they're authenticated or not, pull in two different kind of
UIs, something like that. So super useful, and not a lot of devs know about it. The other really cool thing that not everybody's seen as well is,
usually when you use something like Federation,
you always have to go like import app1/button.
But there's no like index file concept, but there actually is. It's just not documented anywhere. If you just expose a module as dot, so if you just go like pull the name of the module, it's not button, it's just dot, and that goes off to something else. You could just go import app1, and it will pull in that kind of index file. So it's also a useful pattern not everyone's aware of. And I guess the last thing that I would say is definitely look at the articles I've written on the advanced API, because that's where you get tremendous amount of power. And on the vanilla implementation. So
a big misconception as well is, okay, well, everybody has to use Webpack in order to use Federation. In reality, only the
build giving the remote modules, like exposing things, needs to be federated. You're consuming apps. You can do it in vanilla JavaScript, and you can just call the API by hand and pretty much instantiate it, initialize the sharing scope, or create a mock share scope, and you know, put it inside of like a monolith or a jQuery app or something where there is no bundler.
You could sideload this in, or putting it in the tag manager as well. That's also stuff that we've done where analytics is powered by Federation and tag manager is moving over to Federation.
And, you know, so it's definitely worth diving a little deeper, because once you get out of just the basic, I can import app1/button, and you get into the more advanced or dynamic cases, there's a huge amount of power. I guess one last thing, and this is more just a pattern that I've come up with,
but using the at runtime, like the dynamic one versus like the statically imported string, there's this really cool concept that I've used a lot now called automatic service discovery.
So the idea about this is Webpack doesn't know what you're trying to do or doesn't know what you're trying to import. And I use this mostly for like routing. So when I have a catch-all route, or when I have like another route somewhere else, the only option you would have is I need to centralize all the route paths into some file or into a central spot, deploy it out to everybody so they know, okay, this path maps to
this component name or whatever. But using something like a service discovery, you can query
the front end or like query all the connected federated components on the network. And you can do something like, hey, does anybody know what to do with this path? And then one of them will respond and say, yeah, it's this page. And you can, you know, without knowing anything about it, without having to maintain something central, without having to hard code anything, you can just create a catch-all route.
Where, cool, if this app doesn't know what to do with it, query the network, see if anybody knows what to do with it. If they do, pull down the federated
container or pull down the federated component and then execute it. But I never had to hard code or predictably know anything. It can be 100% dynamic, where it's useful also for like user configuration or anything where you can't write the static value, but it's completely user generated. Very handy for those kind of patterns as well.
It sounds like there's just so much to sort of explore and learn in this space. And I would say for the listeners of this podcast, if you're looking for ways to get involved with the community and really start to share your knowledge with people, like these would be great topics to start writing blog posts about or make conference talks about or give a lunch and learn to your company. All of these are good ways to give back. And like you said, it sounds like there's just so much to share that it's hard for a handful of people to share it all out. So.
Yeah. And I think like there's also a really good career advantage that I always tell everybody around learning this is, okay, you don't need to know it at the author level, but if you know the advanced, like how to take advantage of some of the advanced practices. And realistically, we're not talking about a huge surface area you have to learn. It's more like, okay, there's like 15 options and how you can use those options in different combinations and, you know, kind of loophole Webpack. So half federation and half just configuring the build a little differently can open up even more capabilities. And yeah, so you're not, it looks intimidating when, yeah, I talk about it, but I've also been working with it for 2 years. So, you know, I've kind of seen all this stuff, but in general, like if you just want to get up and start with something simple, start simple. And as you need some new capability, dig a little deeper or reach out to me on Twitter and you can uncover more and more that it can do. And, you know, in the long run, I mean, we did a count, like an official count, like last week. And it's something like worldwide, there's only 10 engineers who have an
advanced level of understanding of Federation's interface. So if you do kind of get involved or interested in this, there is a very large demand. And you realistically, there are 10 people across the globe that can actually service some of these enterprise level
concerns. And it's not because it's complicated to use, it's because you need to use it a little bit and just understand the tricks and how to take advantage of it in ways that
the API just happens to let us use it in. So
yeah, and I think there's also
you can figure.
Yeah, and there's a lot of value in being somebody who's just learning something too. Like, I wish I could remember the woman's name, but she was on a podcast and basically it was the AWS, one of the AWS podcasts. And it was like, her experience was valuable because she literally didn't know how to do it when she started, you know? And I think that that's so true. And people are so afraid as beginners to get out there and share what they've learned, but I might be able to explain it to a beginner better than somebody who knows everything about it, because I'm going to forget all those little beginning steps. You're like, okay, but first you have to remember to do this, because you'll take it for granted because you've done it a million times. And so, yeah, I think having those people that are just starting out writing, giving content to people, it's so important. And I want to encourage everybody to do that.
Yeah. And like, I mean, I get a couple DMs on Twitter, but it's usually like, hey, sorry for bothering you. I have a dumb question. And honestly, I would say, yeah, there is no dumb question.
If you want to know about it, DM me. And if I'm not at capacity, I'll definitely respond. But, you know, the big issue that like I have is I can write posts about it, but I'm usually leaning toward the advanced side, or I'm assuming a whole bunch of information because I helped rewrite Webpack 5 anyway. So I already know how it works internally. So it's not even something I think to say, because I don't know, if you built it, it's really hard to think about, well, if you didn't build it,
what am I missing here that somebody else might not know about?
So yeah, having people who are doing it for the first time, sharing the journey, the learning, great video, any kind of content that you can create from either I've been doing it for a while or this is the first time I'm doing it, it's extremely valuable, because the kind of barrier for entry is mostly limited by
the amount of content out there. It's easy enough to use it, but there's only, you know, what, 15, 20 posts
about it. And either those posts are too high level and it's like, what is it? Here's, you know, doing a button or something like that. But if somebody said, okay, here's how you do, say, a routing, or here's how you create like a shared service, you know, even something specific, like how do I share context, or, you know, how do I do something like that? Those are also extremely valuable. So
yeah.
If you want to dive into a specific problem, that's also super helpful, because there's not a lot of content out there. So one, you'll get a lot of traffic. You'll really help the community out. But two, it'll hopefully also encourage more open source tools to come out around it. Federation, again, you know, it's a plugin. It's not a framework. It's happy to let you break your build. So you know, more tooling or more like advanced or just more tooling around it will be really helpful. But in order to do that, we need more engineers familiar with it, trying it out, saying, okay, well, what can they do to
either just say, here, here's how you do, say, nested routing, or here's how you
handle, say, a Redux store, or anything like that. All of that content is really, really valuable.
Very cool. The woman's name I was thinking of was Hiroku Nishimura. I just wanted to make sure and say her actual name because I really appreciated her perspective. So
awesome. Well, I think that kind of wraps up what we're going to be talking about today. So Zach, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your immense amount of knowledge. And again, just want to echo, like, this isn't syntax that like you can easily Google. This is stuff that you can really only learn through experience and trying and solving problems. So some really complex stuff. So thank you for sharing your experiences with us. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks again, Zach, for joining us. And we will see you again soon. Bye.
Bye.
And that's another episode of the Angular Plus Show. Thanks to our hosts, Laura Newsom, Nicole Oliver, and Brian Love. Special thanks to our producers, Brian Smitha and Loyal Carlon, for harnessing our squirrel energy. And thanks to our founders, Joe Eames, Aaron Frost, the entire NGCon team, and to all our sponsors and subscribers for making this episode of the Angular Plus Show possible. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for a future episode, contact us at theangularplusshow.com/contact. Or you know you can slide into our DMs on Twitter @AngularShow. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Angular Plus Show.